Regency of Karim Khan Zand. With Nader's death, his short-lived empire, stretching from Marv and Herat to Georgia and Dagestan, and on to Bahrain and the shores of the Persian Gulf, plunged into turmoil. The mosaic of nomadic and semi-nomadic people took part in a pandemonium that took at least another decade before a semblance of tranquility would emerge under Karim Khan Zand, reigned 1751 to 1779. Despite three attempts by Nader's successors to try to stabilize his amorphous empire, the Afsharid base in Khorasan proved too fragile to allow for an orderly transition. Besides jealously guarding the remnants of Nader's hoarded treasures in Chalat, which came to be a curse rather than a blessing, his successors could barely subordinate Nader's unruly army, no matter how generously and hurriedly they squandered his legendary wealth in exchange for loyalties. Nor were they able to hold together from Mashhad or from Isfahan the disjointed provinces of his empire. The ensuing struggle for power plunged Iran into another civil war that lasted a whole decade. By 1757, the rise of Karim Khan Zand in the south was the only positive outcome. His regency was the most benign and durable of any attempt since 1722 to revive a nominal Safavid rule and govern in the shadow of its memory. Contrary to Nader's diabolical temper, Karim's personality combined political sagacity and soldierly valour with beneficence, acumen, and conviviality, a rare combination, especially when compared to his cohorts. His rule of more than two decades marks one of the most tranquil in Iran's early modern history, a remarkable example of how the ruler's personal qualities, rather than the institutional framework within which he operated, determined political stability, the well-being of subjects, and cultural fluorescence. Under favourable conditions fostered by the Zand dynasty, founded by Karim Khan, Shiraz and the whole of the Fars province, which had terribly suffered under Nader, quickly bounced back. Brought up in exile in northern Khorasan, Karim belonged to the Lak, a sub-tribe of the Zands and part of the lesser division of Lurs of western Iran. They were banished by Nader to the northeastern frontier, presumably to guard against the Uzbeks. Karim had fought in the Afsharid campaigns, involuntarily perhaps, even though Nader had eliminated all senior members of his tribe. After Nader's assassination, Karim led the return of the Zand contingent back to their ancestral homeland in the Mayale region in Luristan. From there, over the course of ensuing civil war, he eventually became the master of Fars province, with Shiraz as his base. Zand victory in effect reaffirmed the ascendancy of the southern Iranian interior, albeit Lur and still tribal, over the mostly northern Turkic periphery, an ascendancy tied to a new sense of Persian awareness. Karim Khan's reluctance to assume royal authority independent of nominal Safavid sovereignty gave his rule a distinctive character. He learned from Nader's mistakes. He was realistic enough to acknowledge the place of Shi'i faith and wise enough to respect devotion to the Safavid memory. Karim's choice to remain Vachil Adole, deputy of the state, however, was a subtle shift from acting as mere regent of an obscure Safavid prince, a non-entity. By allowing reference to himself as the deputy of the subjects, Vachil Aroya, moreover, he seemed to have implicitly shifted his own mandate to that of deputizing people rather than mere Safavid kingship. The subtle shift corresponded to Karim's popularity with his subjects, especially the urban population. Distancing himself from the tormenting experience of the recent past, he further relied on the legends of Iranian kingship closely associated with Fars province. Though the extent of such Persian awareness should not be exaggerated, it is evidenced in the literary and material culture of the period. Tracing the Zand revival back to Fars as the cradle of Persian culture and its rich poetic tradition was one example. Wider use of the term Iran as an alternative to the guarded domains of Iran is another. Interest in rebuilding cities under Karim Khan went along with revitalization of the Persian Gulf trade and development of Shiraz as its hub. Consolidation of the Zands soon gravitated the political center, at least temporarily, toward the south and away from the perils surrounding Isfahan, Qazvin, Tabriz, and Mashhad. Similar to Abbas I, Karim Khan created an urban complex commemorating his political achievements. His reconstruction projects complemented and at times replaced Safavid public buildings and palaces. Most notable among Karim Khan's grand edifices were the new bazaar, the mosque, and a new citadel, Arg, together forming the core of a new urban development. The Zand material heritage, while incomparable in grandiosity to Isfahan of the Safavid era, was remarkable for what it accomplished in a short period of time. It was also notable for its innovations. The design features of the Vakil Mosque, a vast space of more than 90,000 square feet, built between 1751 and 1773, for example, served to reaffirm a new political agenda. The absence of any domed structure in particular may be seen as a break from the glorification of Safavid royal patronage. The use of 48 single-piece marble columns throughout the mosque's vast prayer hall, the well-proportioned courtyards, and high ivans, arched portals, two instead of the usual four, shows artistic confidence. Everyday life in Shiraz. Beyond the political history of the period, we know something of everyday life in the Zand period. A remarkable narrative, Rostam al-Tawarikh, provides details about the minimum wage and the price of goods and commodities. An average labourer in Zand Shiraz earned as much as 9 tumans per year, enough, the author reckons, to feed and clothe a family of seven, the average size of an Iranian household at the time. 1 tuman, consisting of 10,000 dinars, would have bought roughly all the commodities needed annually for such a family. 950 pounds of wheat, 220 pounds of various grains, 115 pounds of rice, 220 pounds of red meat, 25 chickens, and 150 eggs. Another tuman or two would have bought spices and condiments, cooking oil, salt, sugar, coffee, tobacco, soap, wood, charcoal, burning oil, vegetables and fruits, and other necessities. Clothing, mostly cotton, but also woolen and silk for special items, constituted a hefty figure, perhaps as much as 2 tumans. A quality woolen carpet of about 130 square feet was worth about a tuman and a half, but a kilim of the same size was half that price. In contrast, an average urban house cost no more than 10 tumans. Land was relatively cheap as well. 1 jarib, nearly 2.5 acres, went for only a quarter of a tuman, compared to 1 tuman for a jarib of orchard. The most prized items, however, were horses. A pedigreed horse could cost as much as 20 tumans, and even a well-bred mule was no less than 10 tumans. Yet an average urbanite could afford riding a very good donkey for 1 tuman, while a peasant could buy a ploughing cow for the same price and a working donkey for 1/3 of that. Though raging inflation, our source informs us, had led Karim Khan to introduce some measure of price controls, still the standard of living seems well within an affordable range. Rostam al-Tawarikh nostalgically recalls the life of prosperity and leisure under the great Vakil. The author praises Karim Khan for combating crime and restoring calm to Shiraz, well known for its harassing urban brigands, lutis. Among other measures, he instituted a liberal policy of establishing taverns and brothel districts for the troops and for the city folk, presumably to forestall the raping and abduction of women and children, an endemic problem under the Afsharid regime. The author also offers a long list of well-known female entertainers of Shiraz, whom he praises for their sophistication and taste. The charming Mala Fatemeh, no doubt an educated female entertainer, was praised for her pleasant conversation. She was good-natured, tender, and mannerly, never acted presumptuously, always compassionate to the prince and the pauper alike. She knew by heart about 20,000 select verses from classic and contemporary poets, and could recite them appropriately in every assembly, accompanied with tambourine, drum, reed pipe, harp, lute, and kamanche. She was also credited for her intelligent critiques of clerical bigotry and misogyny, as well as for being an advocate of the weak and disadvantaged. According to the Rostam al-Tawarikh, on one occasion quoting the poet Sa'di, she cautioned Karim Khan about the transitory nature of his power and the egalitarian tyranny of death. The Shiraz environment was liberal enough for Fatemeh not only to utter such sentiments, but also to express them in public through poetry and music. At the crossroads of the Vakil Bazaar, she and her band reportedly performed for the public, no doubt in the face of the ulama's objection. The portrayal of female entertainers became popular in the Zand paintings, and later was inherited by the artists of the early Qajar period. Large-scale oil painting on canvas, celebrating court life of leisure and merrymaking, was a late Safavid development, possibly inspired by Italian and Dutch portraitures. Yet it was in the Zand era that the inner life of the harem became the prominent subject of a school of painting distinct for its depiction of women, wine, and music. Portraitures of the Zand and Qajar periods showed unveiled women in private settings, off-limits to the public eye, an indication no doubt of the concern of the patrons of these works not to transgress Sharia sanctions and face criticism of the ulama. Reorienting toward the Persian Gulf. Public space remained primarily a male domain. The Vakil Bazaar and the adjacent caravanserais were not constructed merely to augment the ruler's image or to please the growing out-of-town visitors. They served as the main outlet for the emerging mercantile classes and as a new market for the Persian Gulf trade being conducted through the port of Bushehr, the main entrepot for Fars province. The piracy common in the lower Persian Gulf, French naval attacks on English ships in the area, and the growing maritime ambitions of the Imam of Muscat and his Omani privateers undermined most of the trade of the lower Persian coast. By the mid-18th century, Bandar Abbas gradually ceased to function as Iran's chief port of entry. The British East India Company and Dutch commercial firms searched for safe harbour along the upper shores of the Persian Gulf. They first settled in Bushehr and Kharg Island, and soon after in the rival port of Basra, which was the outlet of Ottoman Iraq to the Persian Gulf. Despite Iran's desire to safeguard its southern shores and its foreign trade, its greatest weakness in establishing a secure presence in the Persian Gulf was its lack of either a naval or a commercial fleet. Nader's effort to build a naval force was a notable exception. By 1745, he had gathered a fleet of more than 20 boats of different sizes, purchased from the Portuguese or constructed in India. Portuguese officers and Indian sailors largely manned his navy. He also built a dockyard in Bushehr, and, at great expense and with much difficulty, he imported timber from Mozandaran for the construction of warships. The major objective was to quell privateers along the Iranian coasts and revive maritime trade, although it is conceivable that he had maritime ambitions in the Indian Ocean. Nader also used the expertise of an Englishman to build a fleet in the Caspian Sea, with the similar objective of securing the Iranian coast from Turkmen and Cossack piracy. He also appointed for the first time an admiral, Darya Beg, to organize Iranian defenses in the Persian Gulf. Yet, after Nader's assassination, the Omanis resumed their raids of the Iranian coast, even carrying off the ships of his navy. By the time of Karim Khan, the ruler of Muscat and the Kazimi privateers, who were operating from the southern coast of the Persian Gulf, were capable of barring Iran from effective control of its own coast. Any effort to establish a naval presence in the upper Persian Gulf, moreover, was bound to face heavy competition from the semi-autonomous Mamluks of Iraq. While keeping their Ottoman suzerain at bay, the Mamluks were eager to host the lucrative trade of the East India Company. This offered the English unprecedented freedom to dictate terms and win greater concessions by playing the Iraqi Mamluks against the Zands. Even a joint military operation in 1768 by the Iranians, the Mamluks, and the East India Company, intended to crush the Ka'ab tribes on the banks of the Shat al-Arab waterway, did not result in further commercial cooperation. It did, however, whet Karim Khan's appetite for expansion not only in the Persian Gulf, but also across the frontiers of Ottoman Iraq. Counting on the weakness of the Mamluks of Iraq and the Sublime Porte's sluggish response, Karim Khan lent substantive support to the chiefs of Iraqi Kurdistan, who sought autonomy from their Turkish masters. But it was above all the vigorous English backing of the Ottomans in disputes with the Iranian state that in 1774 persuaded Karim Khan to send a force under the command of his brother, Sadegh Khan, to capture Basra, the valuable strategic and commercial lifeline of Mesopotamian trade. This was the first time since Nader's overland sorties into the Ottoman territory that Iranian advances had paid off in Iraq, albeit momentarily. The fragile 5 year Zand occupation of Basra, which ended with Karim Khan's death in 1779, proved a failure. It interrupted the export of Persian silk and pearls from Bahrain to Europe, and it discouraged profitable trade with Mughal India, now largely fragmented into regional princely states and progressively prey of French and the British colonial gains. Moreover, it demonstrated the difficulty Iran faced in securing an important commercial outlet to the Indian Ocean, not only to compete with expanding European trade, but also to outmaneuver Ottoman Iraq. As an alternative to the Persian Gulf, Karim Khan also followed Nader's steps in developing the northern Caspian trade with Russia, which was largely conducted from Astrakhan on the Caspian's northern shore. The chief beneficiaries of that trade, however, were not the Zands, but the northern-based Qajars, who, soon after Karim Khan's death, emerged as the chief contenders for control of Iran. Russian commercial and diplomatic presence along the southern and western shores of the Caspian, which included Armenian and Muslim traders' relations with Baku, Anzali, and Astarabad, anticipated Russia's territorial advances in the early decades of the 19th century. Rise of the Qajars. Karim Khan died in 1779, an old man, a rare phenomenon in an era of great political turmoil. With him perished his fragile balance of tribal alliances, built by means of consent and coercion. After his death, as Iran experienced another round of civil war, the third since the fall of the Safavids, the problem of political legitimacy resurfaced once more to haunt the many contenders. Not for another 2 decades, until the last year of Aga Muhammad Khan Qajar, reigned 1789 to 1797, the prevailing leader of the Qajars of Astarabad, did a solution to the question of political authority emerge. The collapse of the Zand dynasty, if it can even be called a dynasty, was a dismal affair. The tribal truce that was the outcome of Karim Khan's political acumen withered rapidly after his passing. In the 13 years between his death and the capture of Shiraz by the Qajars in 1792, which put an effective end to Zand rule, no fewer than 8 contenders successively vied for the shaky Zand seat of power. All but one, who died of acute alcoholism, were murdered in a climate of treachery and violence. In a dynastic free-for-all, brothers fought against brothers and fathers against sons. The seed of the Zand's rapid downfall are to be found first and foremost in the self-destructive behaviour of Karim Khan's successors and the internecine tensions that long had simmered while he was alive. The small Zand tribe, moreover, had to rely on an assortment of other tribal forces, whose loyalties were up for sale to the highest bidder. The haphazard southern alliance of Greater Lurs of Fars province in the south, of which Zand was a member, had to face the Tangestani and Dashtistani warriors of the warm country, the Arab tribes of the Persian Gulf littoral, the Bakhtiyadis of the southwest, and the Kurds of the Kermanshah region. 2 decades of urban calm had hardly tamed the nomadic culture of perpetual warfare among this quarrelling bunch in the south. Karim Khan's wisdom and foresight had clearly failed to instill values of stability and collaboration, let alone a Fars-based sense of shared identity or a commitment to a centralised state. It was as if the Persian urban centres were destined to endure another round of nomadic strife, both north and south. Yet, contrary to Nader's time, the cities, and Shiraz in particular, did not remain entirely passive. Tired of internecine Zand bickering, there emerged a new civic resolve, one that relied on a tacit alliance of landowning urban notables, Ayan, city administrators, and members of the Ulama class. The new urban voice became even more pronounced once a new Qajar contender from the north appeared on the horizon. While Karim Khan was on his deathbed, Aga Muhammad Khan Qajar, who was a hostage in the Zand court in Shiraz, escaped the Zand capital and galloped toward Astarabad, his tribal base in northeastern corner of Mozandaran. After his rebellious father had been killed in war with Karim Khan, The ambitious Qajar heir was captured and exiled to Shiraz, where he spent 15 years in the Zand court under Karim Khan's watchful eye. Karim Khan viewed the Qajars as his most formidable adversary. For 3 generations, since the last days of the Safavid dynasty, the Qajar Khan's bid for power had been rudely interrupted. Tahmasp II's original regent, Fat Ali Khan Qajar, had fallen victim to the more ambitious Nader Goli. Even though, as a member of the Gezil Bash, the Qajar Khan was committed to a Safavid nominal sovereignty, he was no less fervent than his Afshar rival in a contest for power. A decade later, Fat Ali Khan's son, Muhammad Hasan Khan, renewed the family's claim to power, this time against the Zands. After a series of inconclusive sorties that at one point brought the city of Isfahan under the Qajar control, he was contained in Astarabad, where he eventually perished. Some years later, Fat Ali Khan's grandson, Hossein Goli, Aga Muhammad Khan's younger brother, an audacious brute with the self-proclaimed title Inflamer of the World, Jahan Suz, rebelled against Karim Khan. He too was killed in action, ironically at the hands of the Turkmen horsemen who made up his fighting force. It is noteworthy that the Qajar contender relied on the Turkmen tribes of the northeast frontier, as had the early Safavids on the Kazilbash Turkmens of Azerbaijan 3 centuries earlier. It therefore seemed inevitable that Aga Muhammad Khan would take up the family feud, even though he himself was its hapless victim. An Afsharid pretender to Nader's throne had castrated Aga Muhammad at a very young age to disqualify him from any future claim to the throne. In the tribal culture of the period, the removal of testicles, similar to blinding, was a common form of body mutilation. The assumption was that only able-bodied men were entitled to rule. Yet the success of Aga Muhammad Khan in establishing the new Qajar dynasty proved the opposite. The 18th century might be labelled the Golden Age of Mutilation, since no ruler or pretender of the period from a tribal background shied away from the brutal practice. Acts of bodily mutilation also included cutting off the victim's tongue, and, more commonly, the partial or complete removal of the nose and the ear. Aga Muhammad Khan was not just the victim of such punishments, he was their ultimate practitioner. Aga Muhammad Khan's complex personality was no doubt affected by his bloody family history, the bodily mutilation he sustained, and years of confinement in the land of his paternal enemy. His ruthless discipline, his grudges toward family and tribal enemies, his love for booty, especially gems, and his deliberate acts of violence resembled Nader Shah's. Yet Aga Muhammad Khan can be credited for his great success in reunifying Iran, an enterprise in which Nader Shah and Karim Khan both failed. In military discipline and determination, the Qajar Khan was reminiscent of Nader. For his political foresight and desire to rebuild the state as a social contract rather than a tribal war machine, he was indebted to Karim Khan and the Zand administration. He evidently valued continuity more than Karim Khan's own successors did. Contrary to Nader's enmity toward the Safavid Divan, he partially rehabilitated the existing Zand bureaucrats, who themselves often had their roots in Divan families of the late Safavid era. He also learned from Nader's era not to alienate the Shi'i clerical establishment. The rise of the Usuli legal school, represented by a new class of Shi'i jurists, created an important source of support for the nascent Qajar state. Above all, Aga Muhammad Khan assiduously avoided the destructive free-for-all contest for succession, which twice he had witnessed ruin the Afsharid and Zand states. By the time he was assassinated in 1797, he had eliminated nearly all potential pretenders to the Qajar throne. One of the most important political figures of modern Iranian history, he founded a dynasty that survived for more than a century despite many odds. Only a man devoid of private life, who spent more time in the saddle and under the tent than on the throne or in the harem, was destined to bring Iran out of its long period of turmoil. The Qajar success nevertheless depended on more factors than the character and resolve of the dynasty's founder. An important feature of the rise of Aga Muhammad Khan was a shift in Iran's centre of political gravity away from the provinces of Fars and Isfahan. On one level, the rise of the Qajars was indicative of the Turkic tribal periphery in the north reclaiming power from the Persian south, except this time the Qajars replaced the Afshars. Aga Muhammad Khan was attempting to reconstruct the same Gazilbash-like alliance that Nader had earlier assembled, and his objectives for political unification were almost identical to those of his predecessor. On the throne in Tehran. By Nowruz of AH 1200, March 1786 CE, when Aga Muhammad Khan declared Tehran his capital, it was as if Iran was about to witness another contest for Safavid succession. Earlier on, Aga Muhammad Khan was still loyal enough to the memory of the demised dynasty to issue new coins on behalf of yet another obscure Safavid prince, but with his own name included. The date for choosing the new capital, however, carried a centennial significance, as if the beginning of the 13th Islamic century marked the end of the Safavid era and the start of a new imperial fortune. That he now issued coins into circulation, this time in the name of the Mahdi, the 12th Shi'i Imam, was not accidental. Most likely it pointed at his presumption that his rise to power was a prelude to a new imperial era, not dissimilar to the rise of Ismail I at the beginning of the 10th Islamic century. Likewise, as Isfahan was a millennial city for Abbas I, so was Tehran a centennial capital for the Qajars. He was no longer a regional contender, but an autonomous ruler who, utilizing the revenues of the Caspian trade and on the backs of his Turkmen, Kurdish and Afghan mercenaries, secured northern and central Iran, and even held a shaky grip over Isfahan. The choice of Tehran, a leafy town in the southern foothills of the central Elburz range, over Isfahan, proved to have lasting consequences. The locale offered an ideal strategic advantage, for it was a gateway to the Iranian interior and provided easy access to Astarabad and other Qajar strongholds in the north. Moreover, being devoid of a sizable urban population, Tehran was free from Isfahan's pro-Safavid and Shiraz's pro-Zand sentiments. The Elburz range immediately north of the city provided a natural wall of defence, and its many ravines and gorges afforded great hunting grounds with an abundance of game. These features were attractive to the Qajars, as they had been earlier to the Safavid rulers, who had erected a wall around the town and constructed a citadel, and to Karim Khan, who built a small residence where the Qajars later built the Golestan Palace complex. On its southern edge were the ancient ruins of Rages, a city of biblical fame, and later the city of Rey in the early Islamic era. Not far from the edge of the central Iranian desert, Tehran was blessed with another natural defence against southern sorties. The new capital under the Qajars thus came to represent the rising north versus the weakening south. Its geopolitical polarity was to be affirmed in the decades to come by the arrival of European powers on the opposite side of the Iranian plateau, the Russians on Iran's northern frontiers, and British India on its south. Not before the 20th century, however, would Tehran supersede Tabriz or Isfahan in size or significance. As a first step after declaring the new capital, Aga Muhammad Khan aimed to capture the south from the Zands. Since 1786, his repeated attempts had faced stiff resistance, most recently from the last and the most charismatic of Karim Khan's successors, Lutfa Ali Khan Zand. The young heir to the waning Zands had repelled the Qajar army three times, once driving it out of Isfahan. He spent his entire fragile reign, 1789 to 1794, on campaigns, most of them against the Qajars, in attempts to hold the Zand stronghold in the south. Yet the disruptive effects of his campaigns were all the more evident to the war-exhausted people of Fars, and especially to the landowning nobility of Shiraz, who were asked to finance his campaigns. After more than a decade of conflict and economic disruption, some had come to accept the reality of the Zand's eclipse. Among them was the chief administrator of the province of Fars, Haji Ibrahim Shirazi, 1745 to 1801, better known as Kalantar, Mayor, a shrewd statesman with influence throughout the South. Haji Ibrahim Kalantar apparently found nothing more redeeming in Lutf Ali Khan than in any of the seven Zand claimants before him. In 1792, while the prince was out campaigning, Haji Ibrahim conducted secret negotiations with Agha Muhammad Khan. In return for his own security and ability to retain his property and those of his relatives and cohorts, and perhaps with an eye toward the safety of the people of the city, he promised to deliver Shiraz to the Qajar Khan. Upon Lutf Ali's return, Haji Ibrahim ordered the city gates shut and denied him entry into his capital. Through bargaining and stratagems, the mayor then bought off some of the prince's tribal chiefs and imprisoned others, while encouraging the rest of the Zand forces around Shiraz to disperse. The desperate Lutf Ali had no choice but to take refuge in Kerman in the hopes of mustering enough pro-Zand recruits to recapture Shiraz. By switching sides, Haji Ibrahim opened the gates of Shiraz to the eventual Qajar supremacy. Although later in the Pahlavi era, he would become a target of anti-Qajar narratives, painted as a harbinger of the Qajar calamity, in reality, he was a savvy notable who garnered urban influence and economic power to safeguard his city and his own land and property. He was a partner with Agha Muhammad Khan in making Qajar Iran a more stable and enduring state. In July 1792, Agha Muhammad Khan took over Shiraz. He spared the ordinary people from his usual retribution. However, he enslaved a number of Zand women and children as war booty and sent them to his new capital to be dispersed in the royal harem and among the Qajar chiefs. To keep his side of the bargain, he reaffirmed Haji Ibrahim as the governor of Fars and gave him the title of Khan, a rare honour for an urbanite. Suspicious of potential pro-Zand sentiments in his next seasonal campaign, he also ordered the fortified city walls and the fortification around the citadel to be levelled. The purpose of destroying Karim Khan's edifices was to deny the city notables the advantage that earlier they had used against the Zand prince. He further carried off the marble columns and doors of Karim Khan's palace in Shiraz to be reinstalled in Golestan Palace in Tehran. Vengefully, he even ordered Karim Khan's bones to be exhumed and reburied beneath the threshold of Golestan Palace's reception hall, reportedly along with the remains of Nader Shah, where he could step over them every day. He thus callously repaid Karim Khan for saving him from certain death and keeping him as a guest in his court for 15 years. 2 years later, on his next visit to Shiraz, he appointed Haji Ibrahim as his Sadr-e-Azam, chief minister, the first time in recent memory that such rank had been recognized in the Iranian Divan. His successor, Fat Ali Shah, also bestowed on him the title of Etamad Adouleh, trustee of the state, reserved in the past for the Safavid chief ministers, thus anticipating the revival of an elaborate system of titles and honorifics in the Qajar period. He also recruited a number of trusted Zand officials to his nascent divan, which until then had relied on northern bureaucrats from Mozandaran. The southerners soon formed a powerful faction in the divan and were largely responsible for setting the tone of the bureaucratic culture of the Qajar era. The main thrust of Agha Muhammad Khan's ferocity was reserved for Lutf Ali Khan and for the people of Kerman. In 1794, he eventually reached Kerman at a time that the city was riddled by sectarian divisions. A majority of the population supported the Zands, while a minority backed the Qajars. Lutf Ali Khan's escape before the Qajar forces, but his taking refuge in the besieged city enraged Agha Muhammad Khan to such an extreme that he ordered the city to be looted and thousands of its civilians, including women and children, to be killed, raped, and enslaved. Reportedly, he also ordered the gouging out of 20,000 pairs of eyes of the city's residents. Whether this is historically accurate or not, there is no doubt about the level of cruelty displayed by his troops. Even the Qajar historians of the time witnessed and recorded the Mongolian-like atrocities of the Qajar army and the ferocity of the mostly Sunni Turkmen troops against the Shi'i inhabitants. When Lutf Ali Khan was finally captured, The Qajar Khan ordered his eyes to be gouged out and his troops to rape him before sending him to Tehran for execution. His tragic end is recorded in Persian memory, especially in folk songs of the Fars countryside. In the popular memory, his image of valour, virtue, and heroism stood in contrast to Aga Muhammad Khan's vengeful conduct and unhealthy physique, whose deep facial wrinkles, high-pitched voice, and small stature had long been subjects of contempt and ridicule, imperfections that theoretically should have disqualified him for kingship. Building an empire anew. As with disinterring Karim Khan's corpse, the destruction of his handsome rival was meant to reaffirm Aga Muhammad Khan's still fragile legitimacy. Soon after he routed the Zands and conquered the south, he moved on to the Iranian periphery in pursuit of reconstructing his empire on the Safavid model. For the rest of his years, and to some degree for his successors, the urge to recover Iran's lost provinces remained the chief objective. In the northwest, the Caucasian provinces, including Georgia and eastern Armenia, were at stake. In the northeast, Marv and its vicinity on the Turkmen frontier, and Herat and its environs further to the east were the priority. In the south, Bahrain and the Persian Gulf shores, and in the west, much of Kurdistan and even the Baghdad province were not excluded from this program of reconquest. Recovering the Caucasus was of special importance. The revenue from silk and other products and the perpetual urge for booty motivated early Qajar campaigns. Fighting a crusade, Ghazar, provided the justification. The new Qajar ruler of Iran had to pacify Azerbaijan. Once the northwestern tribes were subordinated with relative ease, the size of the Qajar army soared to as many as 40,000 cavalrymen. In the Caucasus, however, Aga Muhammad Khan faced formidable challenges. The autonomous Khans, who, after Nada's demise, had entrenched themselves in their seemingly impenetrable fortresses, such as Iravan, Yerevan or Erevan, today's capital of the Republic of Armenia, and Ganje, in today's Republic of Azerbaijan, succumbed to the Qajar army after some resistance. Further north, the joint principality of Katil Kakheti of central Georgia, an Iranian vassal state since at least the 16th century, showed greater resistance. King Irakli, Heraclius II, reigned 1762 to 1798, who, since the fall of Nada, had ruled free of Persian suzerainty, entered into a treaty of protection with Russia in 1783 in an effort to withstand the reimposition of Persian rule. To the Qajar Khan, such a shift in loyalty was no less than an act of treason worthy of punishment, especially because it anticipated Russian advances in the Caucasus under Catherine the Great and her successors. Irakli miscalculated both Aga Muhammad Khan's resolve and the level of Russian support. More than a decade after Irakli's alliance with Russia, Aga Muhammad was ready to move in and teach Irakli a lesson. After the Battle of Kitsanesi in September 1795, in which the Georgians were outnumbered and soundly defeated, the besieged city of Tiflis finally fell. The Qajar army systematically sacked the city, and thousands of civilians were put to death and raped and pillaged. Georgian priests, the core of the resistance, were thrown into the river. Churches were looted and razed to the ground. As many as 15,000 men, women, and children were taken captive and deported to Iran, where they were dispersed to Qajar households as concubines, eunuchs, and page boys. Not surprisingly, a vast number of Qajar princes of the following generation were born to Georgian and Armenian mothers, as they were in the neighbouring Ottoman Empire, where several princes of the royal family were also born to Caucasian mothers. The sacking of Tiflis marked another shameful episode in Qajar annals. It also marked the beginning of Iran's permanent loss of the Caucasus. While in purely political terms this was a temporary setback for Russia, in the long term it further justified Russian southern expansion, allowing it to capitalize on resentment toward Iranians among the Christian population of the region. Returning from the Georgian campaign, in 1796 Aga Muhammad Khan wintered on the plain of Moghan, on the very same site of Nada's coronation 6 decades earlier. There he was crowned Aga Muhammad Shah Qajar. He reluctantly accepted the title of Shah at the pleading of Haji Ibrahim Khan Kalantar, his chief minister, an indication of the latter's desire to turn an essentially tribal Khan into a Persian monarch. It was in the same spirit that the ceremonial sword of Ismail I, kept in the shrine of Ardabil of the Safavid patriarch Sheikh Safi al-Din, was brought in and wrapped around the waist of the Qajar king. Aga Muhammad's self-styled Kayanid crown, named after the mythical dynasty of the Shahnameh, was inspired by the new Shah's keen interest in Iran's ancient legends. Perhaps the outcome of his years in Shiraz at the Zand court, he listened frequently and avidly to Persian epics that were read to him while he was resting. The new Kayanid crown was a dome-shaped structure inspired by the Gezilbash cap, albeit of gold-plated copper built by a humble craftsman from Mozandaran. Its style was distinct from Nader Shah's feathered cap. He also wore two armlets with the legendary diamonds Darya-e-Nur and Taj Mahal, both booties from Nader's Indian campaign. The other piece, the Koh-e-Nur, which was captured by Ahmad Shah Durrani, ended up in the British crown jewels. Lutf Ali Khan had earlier failed to sell the stones to an English merchant, Harford Jones, at a bargain price to finance the war with the Qajars. Aga Muhammad Shah snatched them away. The assemblage of the Safavid and Afsharid regalia, complete with the dynastic rubric of Safavid Qajar, Safaviyye Qajar, that the court chronicles soon coined for Aga Muhammad Shah and his successor, aimed to put an end to a 75-year crisis of royal authority. But he was not naive, nor was his grand vizier, to believe that Qajar sovereignty could be achieved through the feat of a coronation ceremony. He seems to have reflected on his place in the Persian kingship tradition and his designs for rebuilding an empire when he warned that if he assumed the title of Shah, he intended to be one of the greatest. Beyond the Caucasus, which remained partially insubordinate, Aga Muhammad Shah had to quell an assortment of eastern tribes before moving to Mashhad, the last Afsharid stronghold under Shahrakh, the aging grandson of Nader. With familiar cruelty, in 1796, he deposed the blind Shahrakh, extracting the remaining of Nader's treasures. Before departing from Khorasan, he wrote the emirs of Afghanistan demanding the return of the ancient cities of Balkh, near today's Mazar-e-Sharif, and Herat, Iran's eastern capital of the Safavid Empire. From the Uzbek Khan of Bukhara, he demanded the return of the old city of Marv, the recognized Iranian frontier with the then fragmented Uzbek state. He also demanded the repatriation of thousands of Iranian captives who had been carried off to Bukhara during renewed Uzbek and Turkmen raids, a recurring calamity that would haunt the Qajars in the years to come. The piecing together of the Safavid Empire, now under Qajar rule, evidently shaped Aga Muhammad Khan's imperial project. Back in the Caucasus, Aga Muhammad Shah's last campaign came to a fatal end. He reinstated control over Yerevan, the old Safavid stronghold, and captured the fortress of Shushi, Susi, in Garabag, 200 miles to the east. For a moment, the Qajar repossession of the Caucasus seemed feasible, in part because of a brief lull in Russia's southern expansion after Catherine the Great's death. Yet the situation dramatically shifted when, in June 1797, Aga Muhammad Shah was assassinated at his camp outside Shushi. He was murdered at the hands of two of his private servants, one of them a Georgian, presumably a survivor of the Tiflis campaign. The assassination apparently was a preemptive act by the servants, who had been condemned to die the following day on seemingly innocuous charges. They had quarrelled behind the royal tent. It is difficult, however, to ignore the involvement of one of his ambitious generals, Sadegh Khan Shugah, chief of the Shekak tribe, who could have exploited the servant's resentment to his own unseemly ends. Immediately after the assassination, he robbed the royal tent and carried off Aga Muhammad's beloved treasures, including the Kayanid crown. Then he headed to his tribal base in western Azerbaijan, taking with him the two culprits. In a scene reminiscent of Nader's assassination, the Qajar camp almost instantly dispersed and the allied tribes returned home, the death of the king, Shah Margi, nearly always led to a period of chaos and a struggle for succession. Haji Ibrahim and the Fars troops loyal to him, and the Mozandaran regiment under a Qajar chief, however, quickly returned to Tehran. Surely no one shed tears over the dead Qajar Khan. But even beyond the grave, his vision for an enduring dynasty seemed to have held more firmly than Nader's or Karim Khan's. The ruthless warrior did not leave the fate of his heir to chance or to a free-for-all contest. His nephew and designated successor, Babar Khan, who ascended the throne as Fath Ali Shah, reigned 1797 to 1834, still had to earn his crown, literally, but at least he did not have to fight for it against his many powerful uncles. His predecessor had eliminated all but one of them. That Fath Ali Shah managed to remove the last one without a hassle promised a more orderly succession. This was a great credit to the founder of the Qajar dynasty, who was ferocious but not fickle. The order established at the dynasty's inception was in no small part due to the state officials of the Divan, who became partners in the Qajar enterprise. Headed by the Grand Vizier, they began early on to stamp their image of governance on the emerging Qajar state. At stake were their own survival, as well as the stability of urban life and the agrarian economy. To achieve this, they had to ensure dynastic continuity and structured growth of the bureaucracy. The officials and their affiliates, among them the Shi'i jurists and other urban notables, amounted to an influential group willing to avert another round of tribal resurgence. Reflections on a Gloomy Century. The 18th century, with the exception of the Zand interlude, ranked Iran quite poorly. Even compared to the Ottoman Empire and its tulip era, the once thriving Persian garden appeared dreary and dry. Yet 18th century Iran was not devoid of cultural agility or intellectual inquiry. Liberated from the strictures of the late Safavid Shi'i dogma, one might argue, writers, poets, and artists benefited from the Safavids' cultural repository. Reflecting on the political climate of their own time, they expressed, predictably, a sense of gloom but not helplessness, even in exile or in captivity. One early example was Sheikh Muhammad Ali Hazin, 1691-1766, a representative of the Persian scholarly and literary elite of the period. A prodigy from Isfahan, brought up in the universalistic tradition of Safavid education, he witnessed the agonies of the Afghan occupation and the rise of Nader before immigrating to Hindustan in 1734. In a brain drain that continued throughout the 18th century, thousands of scholars, artists, artisans, poets, writers, merchants, bureaucrats, and religious dissidents took refuge in India. Some escaped the Shi'i conservatism that had set in, others wanted to avoid the political insecurity that ensued after the Safavids' fall. The Mughal court and later the Muslim and Hindu successor princely states were generous patrons and promoters of Persian culture, whether statecraft, historiography, poetry, music, art, cuisine, or court culture. Despite French and English colonial inroads, there was still an appetite for culture and plenty of material wealth in local kingdoms from Kashmir and Bengal, Golconda, Ard, Deccan, and Mysore, just to name a few, all of which patronized Persian newcomers. Employed as secretaries, manshis, advisors, poets, and religious scholars, as well as architects, painters, and calligraphers, Persians, that is, Iranians who represented the Persian culture, regardless of their ethnicity, were often treated as a sort of status symbol. The poet Hazin, who had lost revenue from his estate in Lahijan in Gilan province, could no longer finance his expensive peripatetic habit except by seeking patronage abroad. In 1742, after many years of travel and 8 years residing in India, mostly homesick, he penned the greater part of his autobiography in just 2 days. Interlaced with vivid accounts of the events of the period, his memoirs begin with his childhood and end with Nader's Indian campaign. Different from his nearly 200 Arabic and Persian literary and scholarly writings, Hazin's memoirs are written in simple and direct style and in the first-person singular, allowing him to be unhindered in expressing emotions and impressions. the nostalgia for his homeland, which Hazin praises in his memoirs and his poetry, did not stop him from lamenting the destruction of cities, mass killings, famine, and cholera, and from criticizing Nader's regime for imposing ruinous taxes and extracting them by force, for his oppression and cruelty toward peasants and the urban populace alike, and above all, for destroying the Safavid dynasty. He is particularly reproachful of the declining quality of political leadership throughout the Muslim world, an insight that must have been sharpened after many interviews with the rulers of his time. Of the requisites of heavens in this age, he writes, one is that there is no leader qualified for leadership. As I pondered the condition of each of the kings and leaders and commanders on the horizon, I found them more inferior and repulsive than most, if not all, their subjects, except some of the rulers of the countries of Europe, Farang, who are firm in enforcing laws, Gavanin, and in keeping means of livelihood, and in taking care of their own affairs. Yet, because of complete incompatibility, they are not beneficial to the people of other lands and climates. Hazin's first acquaintance with the Europeans of Bandar Abbas, and later with those in India, was likely the source of this praise, even though he underscored incompatibility with Muslim ways. Attraction to Farang was not quite enough to persuade Hazin to take the advice of an English sea captain to immigrate to Europe rather than to India, a decision he later regretted. Hazin, nevertheless, was open to new ideas and enthusiastic to learn about other cultures. While still in Isfahan, he had conversed with Christian missionaries and read the Gospels and other Christian theological works. He also discussed Judaism with Isfahan's rabbis and Zoroastrianism with Yazd priests, Mobads, though neither impressed him, for what he suspected was their short-sightedness and bias. Hazin also spoke of his youthful love affair, without specifying the gender of his affections, his protracted illnesses, which repeatedly caused him to be bedridden, and his extensive travels, which included at least 62 cities from Baghdad to Banaras. Furthermore, he crafted a careful list of his teachers, colleagues, and friends, as well as men of learning among his contemporaries and his own extensive writings. He wrote not only on the conventional learning of his time, including Aristotelian and Neoplatonic philosophies, mysticism, and jurisprudence, but also grappled with mathematics, physics, and astronomy. Though within the constellation of traditional Islamic learning, he demonstrates in his memoirs a rare sense of human agency, a voice of self-awareness, and belief in historical causality. In his poetry too, Hazin, his pen name means the sorrowful, demonstrated a sense of proto-nationalism, no doubt edified by living in the Indian diaspora. The land of Iran is the sublime paradise, he exhorted in a nostalgic poem. May its domain be under the ring of Solomon-like kings. May the sublime paradise be homeland, vatan, of our souls. May not that ring fall into the hand of the demon. Aspiring for a Solomon-like king to rule over his homeland instead of the demons that had possessed the ring of power, he invokes powerful cultural memories. These are complemented by other cultural references to Iran as the kingdom of Fereydun, the founder of the Kayanid legendary dynasty of the Shahnameh, the throne of Jamshid, Tagdgah-e-Jam, the Persian name for Persepolis, the remains of the Arch of Khazra, Khosro, the Sasanian palace in Ctesiphon, or Mada'in, north of Baghdad, and to Behistun, a double reference to the famous Achaemenid inscription near Kermanshah, and to the nearby Sasanian site. The room and the roofs were shivering, the day Kavus beat the drums of war. It is as though Hazin wishfully was calling for a warrior king to end the Afghan occupation and repulse the Ottoman and Russian invasions. That may have already come through with the rise of Nader, whose patriotic yet destructive conduct resembled that of the Shahnameh's K. Kavus. Through disaster and defeat, one can detect flickers of a new national awareness, one no longer tied to Safavid sovereignty, but to the sorrowful memory of a glorious past, one that repeatedly would be invoked in the later Iranian experience. The same melancholic awareness of the self and of Iran, narrated through an autobiographical account, can also be detected a generation later in the remarkable memoirs of Mirza Muhammad Kalantar, the longtime mayor of Shiraz under the Zands. Heir to an old landowning family of Shiraz clergy and administrators, he was born during the last years of Safavid rule and lived long enough to write his memoirs around 1785 in the captivity of Aga Muhammad Khan in Tehran. Between his birth and incarceration, he witnessed the coming of the Afghan invaders, the horrors of Nader's army, the ruination of Fars following a prolonged struggle among competing warlords, a fluctuating family fortune, and finally the wars of succession that, much to his displeasure, made the Qajars masters of his land. Only a decade or two of the tranquility of the Karim Khan era lightened his litany of misfortunes. In his memoirs, Mirza Muhammad Kalantar is as relentless as he is acerbic, full of wry humour, as he frequently showers obscenities upon his power-hungry enemies, be they uncouth tribal chiefs or corrupt members of Divan. Brimming with references embedded in Persian poetry and folk culture, he writes in direct, almost conversational Persian, and with the frankness of an old political player at the end of his rope. In captivity in Tehran, he was almost deaf, which he attributed to a venereal disease he contracted from a prostitute in Shiraz. He had lost most, if not all, of his substantial estate, and he was disillusioned about his own prospects, as well as the future of his city and his country. Nowhere better than in Kalantar's account do we see the complex manoeuvring of the landowning notables to preserve their wealth and influence against tribal intruders from outside and popular insurgency from within. In tackling this complex task, Kalantar, like his protege and successor in office, Haji Ibrahim Shirazi, and like other Iranian urban officials, relied on his administrative and accounting skills, as well as on his connections with merchants and the ulama. He fostered rivalries between competing tribal leaders, raised his own private army from the peasants in his estate, and played the neighbourhood brigands, lutis, against one another. Kalantar's acute sense of Shirazi's citizenship, however, was not always altruistic or instructive. He had to face the revolt of the urban poor, represented often by the same lutis, and the insurgent peasantry in the vicinity of the city who viewed Kalantar and urban officials in general as self-serving allies of the strongest bidder for power. The growth of the urban notables and their control of the cities, against all odds, is a remarkable feature of the 18th century in Iran as in the Ottoman world. Here we can detect the seeds of an indigenous communal awareness made sharper by the loss of influence and wealth in the south to a new dynastic power from the north. Contrary to Haji Ibrahim, who sided with the Qajars, Mirza Muhammad ended his days regretting his many political errors and reflecting on the causes of his country's misfortunes. May dust be on the grave of the people of Iran. May dust be on the grave of Iranians for this scarcity of capable men. I wish a woman had come to power that would have been competent, like the one in Russia, Catherine II. Central Iran has been destroyed half by this bastard, Aga Muhammad Khan, and half by that rascal, Jafar Khan, the penultimate Zand ruler. Two faithless, two tyrants, two damned souls. Kalantar's complaint then takes the form of a desperate supplication. O God, the pure and the omnipotent, have you created the people of Iran for these two unmanly cowards? You are not impotent, you are omnipotent. Now, for the sake of your saints, and in honour of your favoured, send us a king who at least in appearance looks like a human being. What is wrong with Europeans, the Zoroastrians, and the infidels? Now two demon-faced evildoers who are servants of their evil nature have come to dominate us. Do not allow it to happen, and do not leave your country leaderless. Hinting at an awareness of historical causality, Kalantar then cites a verse by Rumi. The world is a mountain, and our deeds voices. The voices have echoes. To us they will return. He follows with the word of another great Persian poet, his own co-citizen, Hafez. It is our frail and crooked body that we should blame. Otherwise your robe of honour is not short on anyone's frame. On this sober note, Kalantar concludes his memoirs which he dedicated to his wife and cousin, to whom he also left his estate. He died in Isfahan the same year. Hazin and Kalantar represented a broader spectrum of Iranian urbanites, acutely conscious of their country as a troubled political entity rather than an empire. The failed project of reconstructing the Safavid Empire through military conquest, a common answer to the post-Safavid crisis of legitimacy, made such awareness more palpable. Not before the early 19th century did a lasting model of the Persian state re-emerge. The sacred Safavid kingship and the presumed descent of its shahs from the house of the Prophet was a lineage that could not have been easily replaced. Nader's initiation of a new kingship and Karim Khan's vakil status both proved impermanent. The Divan officials who were inherited by the Qajar state proved crucial for the stability of the new dynasty. The post-Safavid experience made this class of landowning notables more conscious of their urban identity and increasingly aware of Iran as a broader national entity. Succumbing to the Qajars as a political necessity came with the realization that urban welfare and the prosperity of the landowning classes, especially in the south, could not be maintained without a unifying power. The Qajars themselves structured their authority not only according to tribal loyalties, but also on the basis of co-opting the Divan class of the Zand era and the emerging class of jurists, known as Usulis, who came back to Iran at the end of the 18th century from southern Iraq, where their ancestors had taken refuge after the fall of the Safavids. The Qajar rulers relied not only on the claim of legitimate heredity that went back to their membership in the Gezilbash of the Safavid era, they claimed for themselves the memory of the legendary kings and dynasties of the Persian past, kings who defended the land of Iran against its Rum and Turan neighbors, identified with the Ottomans and the Turkic nomads of the northeast in modern times. Likewise, the Qajar cultural and artistic expressions remained indebted to the southern spirit of leisure, music, and the good life, a continuity of the late Safavid and Zand eras. What remained largely unnoticed by Iranian observers at the dawn of the Qajar era was the consequential emergence of two European powers on Iran's horizons, the expansionist Russian Empire in the north and the colonial British Empire in the south.